Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. This is Twit Live Special number 347, recorded Thursday, October 3rd, 2019. Cybersecurity and Identity Trends Unlocked.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I'm John Bennett. I'm the SVP and General Manager for Identity Access Management of LogMeIn, and LastPass is one of the businesses I manage. I am super excited to be here this afternoon. I think we have a great topic, we have a great panel, and I want to first of all thank everyone that is in attendance for taking time out of your day, out of your work week, out of your afternoon, your evening, to spend time with us. I think we have a compelling topic. I think that we have an amazing panel. I want to thank Twit TV, the whole team, for being here with us. We've got Leo Laporte. We've got Steve Gibson. We additionally have our CISO, Jerry Berschelt. And we have Bill Cheswick, who is a respected journalist and researcher with us. And we'll talk more about the panel in a minute. So why are we here today? Why are we here this afternoon? Well, LastPass, I think a lot of people in the room know LastPass as a password manager. We've been focused on passwords for a number of years. And one of the things we've learned from our customers over that journey is that passwords are inherently risky. The other thing we learned is that I think everyone in this room recognizes that cybersecurity and the pace of change that's occurring in cybersecurity is really unprecedented in our history of tech. And at the forefront of the conversations that we're having with our customers and prospects and analysts is the increasing importance and complication of authentication and access. So increasingly, you know, being able to know that this is the employee or the contractor or the partner and identifying that person, and then allowing them and authenticating them and giving them access to the tools and the data to get work done. Like, that is increasingly a really important issue for companies to solve. And most importantly, it's about how do we prevent nefarious people that want access to our company or employee data and to use it in a way that's going to hurt either our customers or our company. And so I think this topic of the trends and what's happening in access and authentication is really an important trend. We've had a busy couple of months at LastPass. How many people in the room use LastPass? Awesome. So we're the market leader in both password management vaulting for consumers and for businesses of all sizes. But one of the things that we've heard over the last couple of years was they were literally looking for vendors to provide a more holistic solution and have less point solutions. So a lot of our customers are small and medium businesses, and password management is like the first step in controlling access and managing access to their employees and what they're accessing and how they're accessing and improving password hygiene. And it would be great if we could just eliminate, who wants to eliminate passwords? Yeah. Holy smokes, yes. That's a hot topic we're going to talk about, right? But the reality is that the average employee has 85 passwords. And of those 85 passwords, probably half of them the company's unaware of and unaware of the applications they're accessing and they're using them for work. So, like, just eliminating passwords right now, I don't think it's a reality. But the question is, like, can we reduce the footprint? Can we sort of have a better security posture around that? Well, absolutely. So by deploying things like single sign-on and multi-factor authentication and password managers, we can improve the security posture, we can shrink that footprint. And hearing from our customers that they were looking for LastPass to solve more than just password management and vaulting is why in July this year we actually launched single sign-on, multi-factor authentication, and a full identity offering for businesses of all sizes. So we're very, very excited about that. I want to also say that I think this topic is resonating with us because we're hearing this across our customer base in terms of as they're thinking about deploying new solutions for authentication and for access and other parts of their identity management, the questions that they're asking themselves is, how do I select the right solution? Is this going to work with my existing infrastructure and systems that I spent a lot of money and training my staff and my employees on? Is it going to have the right policies and controls in place? And most importantly, are my users going to adopt it? Right? Like, are my users going to adopt it? Is it going to allow my users to gain access and be authenticated in a frictionless way? One of the points that we hear from our base, and we're looking at research, is millennials now make up the majority of the workforce. And really what they want is they want to be able to access those applications and tools from any device, whether it's been provided by the company or it's an iPad that they're bringing into the workforce, from any network, regardless of what they know about that network. And so I think this is really a crucial topic for us to have. So we're going to have the panel is going to kick off here in a minute. We're going to have a robust discussion about certainly around passwords. We're going to talk about also about biometrics. Like, biometrics are now far more common. They're showing up. They're being included on most smartphones that are in the marketplace. You know, how do they work, and are they secure, and should you be thinking about using them in the workforce? Another topic. So with that, we're going to turn it over to Leo on the panel, but I want to just do one housekeeping. It's the only note card I'm bringing out, is that we have three charities that you all received a wooden token when you came in, and we have three boxes. So we have Code Connect, we have the Greater Boston Food Bank, and we have the Boys and Girls Clubs of Boston. So please make sure that you select one of those and put your token in. If you want to continue to contribute, we have $5 raffle tickets where that'll go to those charities, and we're going to have a raffle at 7:30 tonight. And you do have to be present. I always love these end of event raffles. How many names? We should do a poll now. How many names are we going to go through before we get the winner? So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Leo. And I look forward to a robust discussion. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Hey, we're so pleased to see you all on behalf of TWIT and our panelists. It's really great to have you all here. And thanks especially to John and LastPass for they put this all together, bringing us out. They're the ones who are doing the charity. I think it's really great that they're doing that. I wish we'd start a little earlier because I was sitting backstage with these guys and we've actually rewired the hotel's Wi-Fi. But I think we've made it more secure, I think. So I'm sorry. We did half the panel backstage, unfortunately, but we're going to do it all again for you. I should probably introduce our panelists because they're really great, and I'll start with the guy right next to me. Jerry is Chief Information Security Officer and Vice President at LogMeIn, but he's got a really interesting track record. Chief Security Officer for Demandware, which is a Salesforce company. He's worked at MITRE. We'll ask you some about MITRE because I think that's an interest. A Principal Information Security Engineer there. Sun before that, and like all good security and IT guys, he started as a physicist, right? Isn't that pretty much how it always...
I think a lot of them, yes.
Well, it always like, begins that
there's
way.
There's no other jobs for us, so...
So, Jerry, we're thrilled to have you. To Jerry's left, to your right, Bill Cheswick, who is a rebarbative bandbox of scrofulous bleak drool. How much entropy did I get there? Is that good?
There's a lot there.
There's a lot of entropy.
Maybe, yeah.
If you haven't been to cheswick.com/insult, you too can find a great insult. For all purposes, but it's also a password generator, right?
42 bits, pretty good.
Yeah.
And it's safe for work.
Well, sort of. depends on where you work.
If it's not, I want to know where you work.
We don't know what scrofulous means. I think if you could get some definitions in there, we'll be all right.
You don't need to know what they mean. You just use them.
Just use them. And if you can spell it, you're a better man than I. He was at Bell Labs. Very famously with Steve Balaban wrote a book that is on my bookshelf still, autographed by you, called Firewalls and Internet Security. What was it? In Search of the Wily Hacker?
Repelling the Wily Hacker.
I love that. He wrote one of the very first firewalls, really the first real firewall.
There were other people before.
You fixed one that before that wasn't...
I did improve one.
Slightly improved.
Yeah. The marketing people say I'm the father of the firewall, but they say that about a lot of people.
Are you the father of the honeypot?
No, I did a lot of my honeypot work after Cliff Stahl. I read his book and said, ooh, I want to do that.
And you trapped, what was his name?
Burford. What I called him. That's not his name.
You later found out that he stopped hacking after his mother told him not to.
Yes.
Yeah. But that was also after the Department of Defense called and said, what is going on over there at Bell Labs?
Well, I set up a honeypot and people came in and attacked it. And then they'd attack other places from my honeypot, so I could watch them. And so the question is, am I making a home to hacking? Or what I did was, of course, watch what they were doing and call the people they were attacking and say, you have this problem. And one of the places they attacked was the Army.
Sometimes they shoot the messenger.
Well, the Army came and said, what's going on? They read me I should have grabbed a lawyer. They read me my Miranda rights.
Jeez.
And then I explained what I was doing. And I said, they're going to attack you anyway. If they attack through my system, then we can tell what they're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was not a convincing argument for my management. And we had to shut it down. But it was, I got a paper
out of it. Also, I'll say, make some pretty fine honey. This is some of his honey he brought me. This was
right.
Part of the deal.
That's
I said, right. You can be on the panel, but I want honey.
Yeah, you got the honey.
He styles himself let me see if I can get it right, Melissa Paranologist.
You know, it's as close as they're ever going to need to know.
He studies the pollen that makes up the honey to figure out its provenance, which is quite interesting.
Yeah.
You've got all the stuff on here. So that's very cool. Anyway, we're thrilled to have you.
Pleasure to be here.
Bill. And finally, I don't think I need to introduce Steve Gibson, who is the host of our security show, Security Now, and also kind of a legend in the business. Does anybody remember the Gibson light pen for the Apple II? You're all way too young to remember that. I know you know SpinRite. I first became aware of Steve reading his Tech Talk column in InfoWorld for years, which was the most geeky column in InfoWorld and really an inspiration. So I was very pleased when we were able to become friends and then start the Security Now podcast. And we're going to get Steve to talk a little bit about his current project, which is kind of the future of authentication. But let me actually start with authentication, because I think that... Oh, and by the way, we're going to also make this a podcast, so if your friends and family couldn't make it today or you just want to save this, we'll be posting it at twit.tv.
Or if you fall asleep at some point.
Or if you fall asleep. Let me start by asking... Because we use the word authentication, but what, Jerry, let me ask you first. What is authentic? What does that mean, authentication?
Authentication?
Well, yeah.
Absolutely. So, I mean, authentication is really the process of establishing the appropriateness of credentials that a user to a system has. So it's like you really want to make sure that somebody is allowed to log into a system. Make sure that they have the right to enter that system. And you prove that through various different means. The oldest one is obviously passwords.
Yeah.
That goes back literally thousands of years. For those history buffs, even the Roman army had an officer that was charged with maintaining the passphrase for the night. So that's how long passphrase goes back. Challenge response. I mean, we all know Flash and Thunder from World War II.
Right.
So it's like this is like something that's been around forever to authenticate people.
The difference was
secret.
In those days, you only needed to remember the code word of the day.
That's right.
One.
Yes.
Nowadays we have, as John pointed out, hundreds.
Just a couple. Yeah.
Yeah. When he said 85, I thought, well, that's not even trying. I have more than 500 in my LastPass vault. Why is it hard, Bill? What's hard about it? I mean, you've written about passwords and how bad they are.
Well, they're not all bad. So let me answer that question first. I got an ATM card back in the Nixon administration. And this was great because banks were open between 9 a.m. and 3 p.m., and you had to go inside to the teller to get your money.
Yeah, when's the last time anybody went into a bank, right? We don't have to anymore.
That's because they brought out ATMs in the early 70s. And I've been using an ATM card ever since, and it has a four-digit PIN on it. And four digits is a password. Usually you don't get to choose it, or if you do, they get to reject it. And it's working fine.
But there's only 10,000 choices.
But after four or five, it eats your card. And that is that's how you get out of the game. If it eats your card after 3 billion guesses, that's a different game. And of course, nowadays, last time I looked, a graphics card could check 8 billion Unix passwords in a second.
Absolutely.
Okay, so how are you going to pick a password that a computer isn't going to guess in a few hours?
Right.
It's a great example of multi-factor authentication as well, because you have the card and the PIN. It's like without...
That's the original two-factor.
Exactly.
That is,
Those are the first two factors.
Yep.
Exactly.
So, of course, a lot of it is that some of the people we talk to, you want to know who you are. Your New York Times subscription. Maybe even not subscription. They want a username and a password, and they want to make sure the email works so they can send you stuff. You know, I don't care if someone steals that password, and I have crap passwords I use for sites like that.
We all do, right?
We all do, and that's fine. Yeah. But I'm retired now, and I live on a nice farm because I saved and invested money, and I have a bunch of stocks in an account. That one has a two-factor authentication, and it would be hard to break in. Also, once you did break in, you could buy and sell stocks, but you couldn't ship yourself
the money,
a 1,000 shares of Apple.
Right, right. So, Steve, is there anything you want to add to that?
So I think what causes me to like stop and ask, like, what is going on?
Yeah, how do we get here? It's so broken.
So I was in 73. I was at Berkeley, and in one of the corridors of this marble hall was a Hazeltine terminal.
1200, I think.
Yes.
Yep.
And you punch a button and get to get its attention. And so there was, you know, the classic dumb terminal. And somewhere in the distance was a CDC 6600 and a 6700, which is what Berkeley had at the time. And if you were a computer science student or you had some reason to have access, you had an account. And so you would put in your username, and then you would put in your password. That was 46 years ago. Nothing has improved. We're still username and password. It's insane.
Yeah.
And it back then they were dumb terminals. Literally, you typed things in and it went somewhere, and what it sent came back. I mean, there was no brains there. That's all you could do, was to rely on the person logging in to supply a secret that they had. But today, 46 years later, no one, not anyone in this room, is using a dumb terminal to log into a remote computer. We're using a computer to log into a computer. And so what LastPass has done with a password manager is they've not asked the other end to change its behavior at all. It's still username and password. But because you have a computer that's now yours, at least you have a repository of all of these passwords that are aggregated together to create a password manager. Yet, nothing has really changed
And you haven't solved the problem at the other end, and we know that from all these breaches.
Right.
They have my password, too, if they're not careful with it.
So you still have all of those problems. And so of course, you know, this audience knows that I've been working for a few years on changing that. And really, the concept is when we were treated like dumb terminals, all we had was memory. Now that we are holding a computer, we're using a computer to log into another. Well, now we have processing capability. So we can establish a different relationship with the remote end that provides a whole bunch of features which Even today, I mean, we're beginning to see these things improve, but still there's this sense of not being willing to make the change. And we know that change is hard. We're talking about on the podcast all the time how slow it is to change anything.
We're essentially using password rules that were promulgated not just by the Romans, but you talked, Bill, about the Green Book of 1985. That's still the kind of the default.
And their attack model was to sit down at his Hazeltine with a computer and type at 1200 baud and guess passwords.
Yeah.
So all of the length of password rules and how often you should change your password were based on that model. We're talking Lego typing at the keyboard.
Right.
Not someone grabbing the master database and running a dictionary attack on the hashes.
So the model has not kept up with the capabilities.
Well, no. And in fact, I on that paper you mentioned, I said, okay, if you did it nowadays, how often would you, using their math, how often would you have to change your password? And the answer was every 30 milliseconds. it wasn't, and they had good advice in that paper. It's just that particular part,
not so much. Well, it's 1985. Things have changed a little bit.
Things have changed a lot.
Since 1985. So what would a good authentication system look like? Would each of us, I mean, if you could design the perfect one, I just sat down at my laptop and my watch logged me into my laptop. Is that a good authentication system?
I think anything that's transparent and convenient for users is something
certainly
that goes
with
the right.
Absolutely, yeah.
And failing that, I would use my fingerprint. And failing that, I would use a typed password. So it falls back to the old system.
I think that's the right approach, generally speaking, because at the end of the day, you really need to make sure that users that are using this, which are some, this audience is super technical, so I wouldn't have any worries about folks here being able to
no,
use
it's
even
not
more complicated.
Us, that's the, it's our parents, it's our sisters, and our wives, and our husbands.
And making sure that stuff is easy and convenient to use across the board, I think, is the key element of this kind of thing, because if you don't make it easy, then people are not going to be using it.
So easy is one. But
you also have to really decide how secure you want it to be.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Because
that's important, because Bill was talking about that. His New York Times is not nearly nearly as secure as his stockbroker.
That's right.
Right.
If you impersonate people on a social site, if you're capable of impersonating someone on a social site.
Well, we know. You don't want your Twitter password to get
there
out.
There you go.
We know that.
And so I was like,
nor do you want to allow, as Jack did, Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, allow a SMS message from your phone number to post to your account.
And so
wasn't a very good authentication
system. That's exactly
system.
The point is you can have really, really, really good security. But that then requires that there aren't trap doors that you use to recover from your own mistakes.
Right. So SMS example, fallback, for instance, is a terrible. The weakest link is always going to be the weakest part.
Right.
Of your...
And so if you remove the weakest links, you're also removing them for yourself because one of the most popular attacks is people impersonating you through the same system.
I have yet to see a bank that doesn't have SMS fallback.
Yes.
And they certainly by now know that with SIMjacking, SMS is an imperfect fallback.
Right.
But it's not bad for a second one.
SS7 still is never going to be fixed.
We're just so the most popular fallback means that your most important password is your email password.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because that's how these people recover. They said they go to the email. So if you can take over someone's email account, that's it.
So lock down your...
I was talking to someone the other day. And because I sometimes mention that I'm working on getting rid of usernames and passwords. And first I get this blank look.
What next?
And then it's gravity. We're going to get rid of that.
That's right.
After SpinRite 7, I just want to say, don't worry.
And so they say, oh, yeah.
6.1 will, yeah.
So I say, I have this system. And then they sort of ask me, well, how it works. And I go, well, no, I really don't. Just trust me on it. And then they say, well, I don't really have a problem. And now I'm interested. Wait, so what do you do? And they say, well, when I have to create an account, I just bang on the keyboard for a while until that little area fills up, and I press enter. And I go, okay. And then they say, and I'm logged in. I say, okay. Well, so then you use a password manager? They said, what? I said, well, so how do you log in again? And they say, oh, well, down there it always says I forgot my password. And I always have.
But awesome. I got to point out, Chez recommended this as a method on a site. If you don't have to log in more than once a year or so, That's a perfectly legitimate method, right?
Sure. Well, it depends on how important it is.
Yeah.
But, of course, I'd like to point out, at least, I'm not sure what it's like in corporations now, but it used to be every October when I worked for AT&T, I had to log in and change my medical system. Mm-hmm. And this was always some big, long, magic, important passphrase, which I needed once a year. And what I do is I write it down. I become a father confessor for people. You know,
I think what we're doing right,
but that has to do with your security model. Like, am I worried about the evil maid, or am I worried about somebody out there?
That's right.
And if it's in your drawer and you don't have an evil maid, you're okay.
That's totally right.
Cool. Absolutely. But I think what we're doing right now is like that. That's kind of some of those areas where we really can leverage single sign-on. Because if you are in a corporation, you have a lot of control over the systems that you connect to. It's like at least the core ones, right? It's like not everyone, obviously. But a lot of the core systems, like, for example, HR systems, benefit systems, et cetera. So I think those, leveraging a single sign-on for those is something that where you can go, and then you reduce the number of passwords to really just one or two. Or
describe the single sign-on process for me, just so I know what you're talking about.
So we have a couple of different single sign-on models. I think the first ones really started out with the idea of SAML, right? So I'm sure folks in the room remember when SAML came out. That was like late 90s, early 2000s. You really had like an identity provider. You had a reliant party, and you had actually service provider, the original SAML model. And then you could federate those kind of things together, make sure that you really authenticate once to the identity provider through a password.
So I'd have the Symantec identity app on
exactly.
my phone.
Whatever. It's like whatever works, really. And it's like authenticate that once. And then once you're in, it's like every time somebody else wants to come in, like Kerberos also, it's like you essentially...
That's kind of the model for my watch log into my computer, right? Apple has authenticated me on the watch, and then from then on assumes that, well, I can use Apple Pay because I've authenticated with them. So it's a simpler system. Is it as robust?
I would say yes. Like if you look at how SAML's been rolled out, OpenID and related kind of protocols have been rolled out, it's really robust. But it's like you have one single sign-on for your company. You have another single sign-on for your social kind of website. You have another single sign-on for your other social website. Your bank maybe issue another social single sign-on credential to get also to your FICO scores. So it's like there is a proliferation of those kind of single sign-on mechanisms, which kind of like, okay, we're back to like having 20 passwords just for the single sign-on mechanisms.
Yes.
Have we reduced the threat surface? Yeah, sure, but it's still not as small as we want it to be.
So, and the other factor of there is that you are introducing a third party where you are concentrating responsibility.
Yep.
You get benefit from that, but also risk from that.
Yep.
Whereas in the broken username and password model, at least it's only between you and the remote site.
And if you didn't reuse your passwords,
thank you.
Which everybody does, but if you didn't, you would at least be eliminating this cross-site problem.
That's actually one of the cool things about LastPass. If you look into the admin panel, it's like you can actually see how many passwords people are reusing. So we just did we don't know what those passwords are because it's zero knowledge.
But they're hashed.
No, seriously. But they're actually encrypted AES-256 and then only decrypted on the user's device.
Right.
But it's like on the user's device, you can compare. It's like, okay, how many of those are the same? And it's like on the average, like out of, I forgot, like the 85 passwords, at least 13.
I don't know who would read.
Oh, I'm on. Only for the New York Times. Only for the New York Times,
well,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know,
I was like reusing
for
them.
A long time. Monkey123, and then I saw that in that list of most
that
used.
That was taken, Leo.
That's right.
I had to stop doing that.
But that was number six.
Honestly, I think I'm. I mean, look, I think I'm fairly sophisticated about this, and I used to reuse passwords all the time because I don't care if somebody gets into my New York Times, do I?
You know? Probably not.
Yeah, I mean.
So I, you know, about 15 years ago, I was rated as one of the top 100 most relevant IT people in the world.
What happened?
I should tell you, I was number 98.
Okay.
And number 100 was Ben Bernanke. So I'm not sure what the scale was around, but I thought, okay, I'm a little bit famous. I'll be like a Hollywood starlet, you know, trying to save the whales. Maybe I can get people to fix this awful password mess. Because everybody has this. You talk to your parents, anybody, someone not in the field, passwords are a pain in the neck.
Oh, yeah.
And there are stupid rules out there. For example, if you type the same password twice, that shouldn't count as a separate try. You know, I'm a fast typist. No. Okay. No, that should be one try if I type the same letters. There's no security thing there. That would be nice. So what I wanted to do was get people to go into multi-factor authentication, one-time passwords, and so on. And the pushback I got from companies were things like, well, you know, we put in our HR system 7 years ago, and the guys who did the authentication stuff, they're gone.
They're gone.
And we don't want, we're afraid to touch it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's going to cost money, and that money gets charged as overhead. There's no profit in doing that. Mm-hmm.
Well, and the reason I think banks use SMS is because they don't want the calls from their customers saying, well, your fallback, I can't use your fallback. Or I still see mother's maiden name, you know, the secret questions.
Yeah.
And well, there was, I was just on the United site, and they give you a drop-down for the question and a drop-down for the answer.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they, whoever did that obviously knew this is a terrible idea, but they decided, but a better idea than having thousands of calls from people who can't remember their passwords.
I want to push back a little on this. You know, once you've tried one of these systems and you have a few years' experience, there are MBAs with spreadsheets who know exactly how much the fraud costs.
Right.
They know how much it costs when you call to change it.
Right.
They know how many people are saved by the obvious questions and answers. And if they've been working for a long time, it may be that it's not broken,
it's
even though we think, oh, it's pretty weak.
Yeah.
And because if they're losing a lot of money, that's money, and they'll come and fix it.
That's essentially why it took so long to introduce the EMV chips in the U.S., because
yes.
the losses were not big enough. And even today, it's like we're not using pins.
Yeah, we still see chip and sign.
We're still doing
like that. Like that signature somehow is some verification of your identity.
You know, about 15 years ago, I was at a meeting with the head security guys from Visa and MasterCard, and I asked them, when are we going to chip and pin? Because Europe had it all over the place. And they said, we probably never will. Why? Because in Europe, the phone call to check your credit card is expensive, and it's cheap here.
Yep.
And we know what our losses are. I mean, this is all spreadsheet stuff. It isn't like they're not paying attention.
Well, and the other point about logging into New York Times, Leo, is that there are also users who, I mean, we've done a horrible thing to the world. I mean, we're abusing people with this whole username and password model.
Yeah.
And so individuals have figured out their own strategies to, like, to make sense of this. And so there are certainly people, I talk to them, I hear from them, who consider low importance sites, low security sites, where they all, across those, they use the same password.
Right.
Because those they are the don't really matter if someone hacks them sites.
Right.
And then you've got your bank and hopefully Amazon and a few others.
And your email.
Where it does matter, those you give each their own password so that they're not having the shared password problem. So again,
part of the reason I do that is because I'm going to enter it on a phone, where it's a bigger burden for me to use proper passwords.
Oh yeah, I have Newt passwords are a pain in the little Apple keyboard.
Semicolon, capital G. I've heard
of this thing called LastPass.
Yeah,
just fills it in automatically. I've heard of that. Yeah.
Well, and even the time-based password thing. I mean, I've got a bunch of them now on all the things that really matter, and so I'm having to look to see how much time is left on the clock.
You know, there
in order to like.
By the way,
you said that on
the show, and somebody wrote me said, you know, you have a little extra time besides the 30 seconds. You know that, right? It's going to still be good for another 30 seconds. You don't have to do it in 30 seconds. You know that, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Just
sometimes
saying.
Sometimes I'm a little slower.
Yeah. But I do want to challenge this things like that is really not that important to care about the blog on or the forum on New York Times or so.
Because,
we're using those passwords. Absolutely. So for all the sites that are really not important. And then we also used the same password, like way back when it was on a site that was maybe a little more important.
Right.
We forgot to change
true.
It because we never
that's
cared about
true.
It,
yeah,
right?
It's true.
So it's like you have like then all these kind of forums, and it's like vBulletin just was vulnerable. Instead of you get the dumps out of those kind of things.
That's right.
You try the password. You go to PwnDB2 on Tor or any other favorite kind of thing where you want to get it. Download the kind of old passwords you have, and then you try them out. And with the password spraying attacks you've seen, one of those days you find one of those not quite so unimportant sites, right? Yeah. So maybe not the bank account, but maybe
it's
an old email address that is still with your phone provider, right?
It's very
because
hard
never
to keep track
it.
All of that.
And that's
exactly
lateral
right.
movement, that's really what worries me the most, and that's why I really been now trying to do
every single time
a new long password.
Anybody get the blackmail spam where they say your password in the subject of the blackmail?
Yeah, I got that one.
That's scary.
Well,
because it was.
You read it and say, wait a minute, this wouldn't work on my computer. because they're giving all this gobbledygook about how they break it. Well, I don't have a camera on this.
I took the chance that they would mail the video of me to every family member.
Absolutely.
I figured I'd probably
all right. Okay. Yeah.
But
it's got to work.
It was scary because it was a password. My old, I used this over and over again for my insecure site's password, and I recognized it, and I thought it was a pretty good password at the time. It was not monkey123. Mm-hmm. So that shows you that was a password breach some time ago, probably a V-bulletin or something like that. And so that does show you. So, all right, so we know what the problem is. We even kind of know what we want to do. We want to do something people will use. Mm-hmm. We want to do something that authenticates you in a way that is strong. I think one other thing that we didn't add, we were talking about it backstage, is there's also an issue of privacy, that you'd like to have a strong identity, but sometimes people want to act, you know, they want to post anonymously, but still have a strong identity. So you want something that is associated with your identity that you could prove you are who you say you are.
The other question, too, is, and this is not the right audience to ask, but I think a lot of people really don't care.
Well, most people don't care.
Right? I mean, they
99%.
They're like, this is an annoyance.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and
people don't care about anything,
though,
Steve. I got to tell you, except what's for dinner. I mean, it's not. If you're waiting for somebody to care about this, what we have to do as an industry is come up with a solution that even people who don't care can use, be comfortable with, and think ahead. And this is where Chez talks about this a lot. In order to be a good, you know, to design a good firewall, you have to think like a bad guy. You have to have kind of almost a disaster mentality. How would I attack this? Yeah. So in order to do this, we have to think about what the worst case scenarios would be and plan for that because the normal user does not.
Yep.
And not only doesn't care, doesn't have the skills to figure out what would be the right way. Or is it possible to come up with a system better than I'm asking the wrong guy.
Yes. Do you know of such a system?
So you've designed something, and I don't want to make this a big, long ad for Squirrel, because first of all, Steve's just come back from his world tour explaining Squirrel to Sweden
and Dublin
and to Ireland, and we're going to do a special Squirrel video on Twit so people can understand his authentication technique. And you've talked about it, and there's lots of information at grc.com, your website. So we don't need to go into the details that much, but I'd like to know what problems you were solving and how you thought about addressing that. And then we can talk about whether that makes sense, and if there's anything left out, we'll let Bill Cheswick try to break it.
Oh.
So this began in the post-Snowden era, where we realized that our suspicions that maybe the government was monitoring the internet was like not just a suspicion. I mean, we've now had someone saying it's really happening.
Yeah.
You know, the NSA has nodes everywhere. And back then, also, you know, you would switch into HTTPS only for username and password because encryption was still sort of a little slower. And so then you'd switch back to non-encrypted. The point being that we were not trusting a third party. And so what I tried to do, and now 5.5 years later have, is to design a two-party solution where you do not need to create anything for every site that you visit. That's sort of done automatically because the sites have different domain names, so it's tied to the domain name. The individual creates one identity once that can potentially last their whole lifetime. It's whereas a username and password has a problem with a replay attack, because if someone were to monitor it once, that's all they need to then impersonate you subsequently. So it also offers protection from that, because a random number is sent to you, which you sign with the private side of your key, which the server verifies with the public side, which is also how it knows you.
So it's public key crypto, basically.
It is the simplest possible public key crypto for authentication, where you're identified by your public key, which is also used to verify the signature. But because it's just between you and the site, then the question is, all of the what ifs. What if you forget the password you use to say that you still have to identify yourself to your smartphone.
You have a private key store, you have to say, this is me.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
So
that somebody doesn't grab your phone and then impersonate you universally. So, and what if you forget that, or if you lose your phone, or if malware gets into your machine and gets your private key, so you need to be able to re-key, to recover your identity if it's stolen from you, and basically... That's where
that's
all the other,
challenge,
the rest of
the sites.
The rest of the time went to providing all of these recovery systems in a system where there's no one to say, oh, I forgot my password. There is no, you know, link to click to say, help me. So it is a secure, single factor, public key based two party solution that has answers to all of those problems.
Right.
And I'm done.
And it's challenge response.
And it's free.
And I think it's you could even claim that it's a little bit more than just single factor. Because, I mean, sure, it's like you have a knowledge proof that you have a knowledge proof, and you have a possession proof of those kind of keys that you have.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's
a soft possession. So I would say it's like not really like a full two factor, but it's darn close.
Well, the way I agree. The way I think of this is that the reason we had to create multiple factors is that no one of them was strong enough to stand on its own. And for example, in the case of a time-based token, well, that's six digits. So it can confirm your identity if you have already alleged who you are, then you're able to add that. But those six
by
digits
itself,
do not by itself it doesn't identify you.
Mm-hmm.
So we have multiple factors because we needed to like team them up in order to get enough assurance. With this system, because it uses public key crypto, it's just one thing. You are able to assert your identity and prove it at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Okay.
And
two,
it's free and open source.
Two
and
questions.
Done.
Okay,
how long
break
is,
it, Chaz. Break it.
Two questions. How long is the public key?
Elliptic curve crypto.
Okay.
So it's Dan Bernstein's 25519.
Okay. And do you eat your own dog food?
He would if anybody would just start using it.
Yeah.
Because that's the other side of this is you have to get sites to support it.
Correct. And so what...
Your forums use it. Forums do to use it.
Well, the forums use it, yes. There is, for example, now an official WordPress.org plugin. So more than half of the sites on the internet could use it if they wanted to.
Okay.
So there is a plugin for that. Also, in terms of the responsibility on the server side... It has to store a key. It has to be able to generate random numbers in order to create a nonce challenge that you sign. And it has to be able to verify the signature. I mean, it's basically three things it has to do. The point is that most of the work is on the client side, which is where you want it, because you only need one for iOS, one for Windows, one for Android. And those all exist, by the way, now. And you want most of the work there with a little bit of implementation over at the server end, because that's what you need to have done, all over the world. So.
And I think the idea behind that is absolutely cool. It's really aligns a lot of like using strong crypto across the board. What I'm thinking is like from your original question, what do we need from an ideal authentication system? I think that is like the far end of like a super high secure and easy to use system, super great. But you also still need to get all the other sites that have not upgraded, all the other kind of legacy systems to deal with, and the HR system that is like seven years old, and that will never, unfortunately, at least from my experience in the real world, never be upgraded because nobody in house is really.
We could stipulate passwords are never going away.
Yeah. Oh, no, they're not.
Well,
that's pretty much obvious, right?
And in fact, because
unfortunately,
we know that there's this weakest link problem, right? And so one of the things that I did is in Squirrel, there are two flags which you can set in the user interface, which is request Squirrel only login and request no authentication bypass. And all they are is they're just flags that sort of, so it's after the user gets comfortable with Squirrel, sort of understands how it works and so forth, they're not on by
That's
default.
Good.
You can then turn them on. And all they are is they just send a beacon to the sites that you authenticate to saying, I would like you to disable everything but squirrel.
No fallbacks.
No fallbacks and no account recovery. And, of course, you can test to see whether they've honored your request.
And then the actuarial guy in the accounting department says, under no circumstances should you honor that switch, because we're going to get that call.
No, the CISO would probably support this.
Have
you talked to the PAM people at Linux?
I've talked to nobody.
Oh, you want to talk to them. If you get it in Linux, a lot of this will go.
That's true.
And
that's
PAM true. Takes modules
like
that.
I like you.
Yeah. I don't know who that is, but I could find out. That's what you want. That'll get you Linux and Unix.
Yeah. I want that.
And, you know, that's most web browsers
most
now,
servers
right?
And most browsers.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about you guys at LastPass are doing, I think, really interesting additional multi-factor based on, well, Google's doing gate analysis, for instance, in your phone.
Yep.
Each of us has a unique gate as we walk
yes.
down the road.
Oh,
and that phone could be, ask the Chinese. That phone could be a token of your authentication all by itself without any additional work. Stuff like that. That's an interesting...
You're going to biometrics now is what you're
basically
switching
biometrics.
Us over to. Yeah.
Actually, it's interesting. I was talking to somebody. I think there's a couple of people here from Viridium. They do a multi-finger authentication using a camera.
Mm-hmm.
And I was asking him, because Apple has said, you want to use Face ID because fingerprint is so bad. And I thought, is that right?
The numbers I heard, and I don't remember from whom, was that the Apple fingerprint was about 16 bits.
Yeah.
And the face is about 20 bits.
Yep. So it's not that...
Which is not bad at all.
Yeah.
In terms... Also, when I heard the Apple announcement, we're going to do face, I thought, oh, God, if I were in charge of this project, how would I make this... You know, what are the tests I'd run through it? And they hit every one of those.
Okay.
Yep. I was impressed.
Except that if you have a twin brother... Or you look a little like your mom.
Yeah, or you look at it and when the guy holds it up to you and you look and see, I just logged in.
But at least you're Bill. I mean,
well, that's true.
You also have the benefit of the multi-factor confirmation because it's the physical device that is in the same location as
absolutely.
You.
Yes.
And
that's
so,
right.
So
you or a 3D model of your head.
No, well, they tried that. They had Hollywood make 3D models, and they didn't work.
Okay.
But my point is that even though 16 or 20 bits by itself doesn't sound like a lot.
It's a great addition.
And yes, exactly. Yeah. And in remote authentication, it's not enough. Yeah.
But it's second factor, and it's in your
credits. Unless they cut off your thumb and then ship it somewhere.
And steal your finger. And steal your phone. At the same time, because that's really you're absolutely right. It's the same idea as behind the credit card with the four-digit PIN. Four digits is really not a lot.
It's terrible.
No.
But it's like at the same time, you need to have the card in the same place.
Right.
Same with the phone and the Face ID or even fingerprint. Is you it's like you really have to steal the phone and you have to steal the biometrics. I mean, it's like if you don't go for like a really rich biometric sensor, so just a 2D camera instead of a 3D camera, it's kind of high guys.
Well, we've seen that with other manufacturers.
Yeah.
So that's probably not the ideal solution, but it's like at the same time, it's like if you really have strong biometrics, then and a phone, a proof of possession of the phone, you really enter into like true multi-factor authentication. You can add, if you have actually phones, you can add, this is what we've been doing, is like location data based on the phone.
Yeah.
So
if
the phone and your face happens to be in Boston, then yay, hooray. But it's like if the phone and the face happens to be in, I don't know, some oblast in Ukraine or so, maybe not me, because I was here just like
And we know
ago.
That this is what Google is doing too, right? Mm-hmm. They're pulling all these different signals together.
Yep. Yeah. I'll get an email saying, well, you just logged in from Lithuania. How could that be? Yeah.
Monkey 123.
Yeah, that's why.
That's exactly it.
Is your password?
I have learned a password.
So what's interesting is, first of all, you guys, you think in a different way than normal people, including I'll include myself, think. You're thinking in a threat model that's very different. But fortunately, we don't have to think about that if these are well designed.
Yeah.
Yes?
I think that's mostly correct.
Yeah. And Squirrel's a good example of something where I don't really have to know what's happening behind the scenes. What does it look like to the user?
It's so fantastic.
All right, I'll tell you. I want to see it.
So
literally, you go to a computer you've never touched before, like the business
you're at the
center,
library.
The business center at the hotel, which is probably covered with horrible malware and a chain of keystroke loggers. They just plug into each other. on the keyboard. And so it's like, oh my God, you don't want to touch it.
Plus all the head cold in the world.
Exactly. And so you bring up a site you want to log into, and they support Squirrel. So there is a little QR code on there next to username and password. So you get your phone and...
You have to open the Squirrel app.
And here's the Squirrel app for iOS. It says scan Squirrel QR code. So you let it see that. You let it see your face. And the page updates, and you're logged in. And that's the same experience. That's the experience every time, everywhere, period.
How do you spell that app?
I'll have to have Jeff send it to you, because it's not yet on the app store.
Oh.
But he'll do
Test Flight.
Yeah, I'm sure they have a Test Flight.
Oh, yeah, it is Test Flight.
Yeah, I do that.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. That's pretty good user experience. Yeah. I'm not crazy about QR codes, but we're all used to it now, right?
Well, that's like the sexy way of logging in. We're like, oh, look, it saw me, and I'm logged
Steve
in.
Steve has a different definition of sexy. I just want to point out.
I think that's pretty sexy.
But
most of us are using a desktop computer. There the client is in the machine, and so because the other thing next to the QR code is... click to sign in with Squirrel. So there you have a client
on your machine that just logs in.
Yes, and so you just click the button, it pops up, and then does the transaction for you. But what's different about Squirrel, what I like about it, what I'm hoping helps it, is that the create an identity, print out your identity, put it on paper, it's in a drawer. That's exactly what
it's
I recommend.
I permit it.
Thank you. We're getting along well.
Yeah, that's right. That's good.
And so the work is up front. From then, it's just like the lowest friction experience possible. It could not be easier to use. And so as we've talked about, that's what users want, is this thing to be out of their hair.
Absolutely.
Just not in their way.
Yeah, but they also, what they don't want is to download an app and install a thing and do the thing and the thing.
Well, and if Microsoft and Apple built it into the browser.
Or a PAM module.
Part of LogMeIn and LastPass, then it's just there.
Yeah. Is the server code open source?
Yes.
Okay, so it should be easy to drop into PAM. And I would expect a few of these people to do that
before
the day's
over.
Actually,
there is a PAM. I think there is some PAM thing. I don't know.
You need to know that answer. That's important.
That would be helpful to know.
It has PAM.
That's not spam, though, right?
No,
that's
PAM.
Just the PAM.
It's
password authentication module.
Yeah, that's right. It's the way you add new authentication to Unix.
Yeah,
let's do that.
Yeah, it's modular, which is
nice.
Yeah, yeah. I still feel like users are just going to go, I don't know, what am I?
No, it's got to be built in. Yeah. It's like my phone can see me because Apple built that in. And so eventually that's where it's going to go.
Yeah.
But
is Apple the hero somewhat in this, because they're really pushing forward with a secure enclave and biometrics and really putting this in everybody's pocket? Is that...
In my judgment, Apple is the safest client available.
Yeah.
I didn't say it was safe. I said it was safest.
Yeah, we know it's not safe. There's zero days.
Reading papers about people who are fiddling around the edges with it. But I think it's safer than Android, and I don't know of another system that's safe.
I totally agree with you with out of the box. But it's like, I mean, I would say it's like if you really know what you're doing Android, you can make that darn safe.
You might, but of course, that's not what we're talking about having people do.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Google does care about security, but they have to distribute it to so many places.
Right.
And, one of the keys you could do is there a virus checker for your client?
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Checking for viruses is like checking the running background checks on the hobos living in your bathroom.
Yeah.
This is a problem grown-ups shouldn't have to worry about.
Right.
Why should someone be able to run a program on your computer that you don't want them to?
Right.
They're escaping. And, of course, there are thousands of really clever ways of randomizing things and kernels and putting markers on stacks to prevent this stuff. This is not a problem we should have in the first place. And as far as I know, there is no virus checker for iOS.
Mostly because Apple wouldn't give you low-level access to...
That's exactly right. They redesigned everything and came out with something that was fundamentally more secure so that attack was not feasible.
Right.
And that is why I think we're going to win the security thing eventually.
It's also going to be putting strong biometrics in people's pockets.
That, absolutely. And the trusted computing machine in there is pretty darn good.
Yeah.
I mean, when the FBI has to spend millions of dollars to break into a phone, that's a good sign.
Right.
And so those are the sorts of things I look for.
Your tax dollars hard at work.
Well, I have some sympathy for them, but they have other ways of not going dark.
That's true.
And
and I think one of the cool things about this kind of general motion, particularly from a privacy angle, is that these biometrics are decentralized. It's like you're not building a centralized kind of giant database with a lot of biometrics.
My fingerprint, my face is not sent.
Just the phone.
Stored in the enclave.
Right. And I think that's something that is sometimes gets lost in some of those discussions when we talk about, ooh, biometrics are awesome. Ooh, they make it so easy to log in. It's like we've had, like recently in Logan, a trial run where you didn't have to present your boarding pass any longer. You just walk up to the gate. There was a nice little camera. It would light green within like a second or two. I'm asking, where did those faces come from? This is like an example of a centralized database where I'm starting to get somewhat nervous. It's like having this decentralized, having this in like an MFA kind of token, having this in an MFA.
I remember when we talked about the Disneyland
fingerprint.
The knuckle. So for a while at Disneyland, for one of their fast passes, you would use a fingerprint. And we had somebody call in and said, was it his knuckle or his elbow?
He
was
not. Whatever body
part.
No.
A different body part. Which was apparently just as unique.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's exactly right. You don't want Disney to have your fingerprints. You don't want the government to have your face.
Well, and now we hear stories of the DMV selling people's information for profit.
Right.
You know, it's like, wait a minute. That
so we've added a new part to this perfect authentication system. It needs to be decentralized. Right?
It has decentralizing capabilities, I would say. I think they're again, it's like going back to
you
single
sign-on.
You don't
want a database of private keys.
Yes.
Because that's going to be a problem, right?
Yeah, at least not centralized. Yeah, at least not with like one big
server. Well, LastPass has a centralized one, but it's encrypted, and it's only encrypted.
Yes, we don't see it. So it is local on your device. It's again, it's like brought to the device, right? So it's like, yeah, sure, all the passwords are there. It's like we actually have to encrypt the blobs for them. But actually, when we get subpoenas and asking us for, can you give us all the passwords for user X, Y, and Z? We can't. We literally cannot. We cannot provide that.
And I think that. Yeah. I think increasingly companies want to be in that position. They don't want to be in the position where they can hand that stuff
over.
And it's actually something any company can engineer and say, look, we don't want to have that information on our on our data bases.
I heard that, I think it was in 2007, was at the FTC kind of a hearing where they were starting to think really about privacy and personal information, et cetera. I think the best way that they always stuck with me in terms of describing PII, it's digital cocaine. It is really, really valuable. It's like you don't want to lose it, and you can monetize it extremely well, and you get super addicted to it over time.
And you don't let your cousin come over and try it.
Oh, absolutely, So.
Actually, I think I just thought of our next panel, which should be a panel on trust, because that goes hand in hand with this, right?
Yeah.
Because there are people that you trust, people you don't trust. Who should you trust, and how can you assess the trustworthiness of Apple or LastPass?
I trusted the government with my clearance information.
Right.
Sorry.
Right. And then they got hacked. Right.
Though I asked around, and apparently they don't actually store the images of the fingerprints. They store the description of the points. So it's some sort of metadata.
So that's actually good. That's
which is
slightly...
Right?
Well, I think Apple does send a hash up to the servers. I may be wrong.
It has a big, complicated key inside that it unlocks and sends that out.
Nice. We collected question cards, right? Karsten, you have those question cards? So instead of having you raise your hands, which is going to be a little bit...
There's a lot of people out there.
Challenging. Thank you all, really,
for being
here.
There are two trucks driving at us. Yes.
And I'm sure you've come up with more questions listening to this. In fact, I have. But we'll start with these.
I filled my rings.
Do they still have question cards they can hand out?
Yeah, thank you.
I can pass them out.
Yeah, if you have raise your hand if you want another card, and Karsten can get a card. Because I realize now that, of course, you're going to have different questions.
Yeah.
He's going to go get cards. So here's one. What can we do as a community to help with the adaption of Squirrel as we know, the username password system is broken. How can people who know about Squirrel help? Tell your favorite website, use it?
That would be great. Yes, yes, yes.
Tell
or
CISO of log me in. It'd be good to put it down. go to your favorite Linux kernel committer and say, we should put this in PAM.
Yeah.
A couple of ways you can do
that. I would have advice on your web page on how to put it in a web server.
I think
so that
exists.
It's easy. I think
it's documented.
If it's already there, because, you know, if you get enough web servers with it.
Right.
Yeah.
And critical mass is so important. If nobody's doing it, it doesn't help.
And if Apache, you'll use it easily.
I remember in the beginning of the internet, because, you know, we're old.
Yeah, we are. It's true.
That people used to say, well, no one's going to be on the internet because there's no stuff on the internet. And no one's going to put any stuff on the internet because there's no people that are going to go. And it happened anyway. Yeah. And so for Squirrel, my hope is that because the work is done, there's it's all open source, it's the user experience is so good. And also, for example, I was talking beforehand about how there is now a WordPress.org plugin, which makes it just dead simple to add this. How many times have we gone to read somebody's blog and thought, oh, I have something to contribute to this? And so you click on, you know, reply and immediately create an account. And it's like, oh, no, you know, not one more.
Hasn't SSO helped with that, though, like Google, Twitter? Now Apple has a single sign-on.
So, yes. So it's like, exactly, that's a great point. So, you know, signing with Facebook, signing with Google, so forth. Of course, we know that they're offering those services because they're tracking you.
Right.
I mean, so they actually know who you are. Now they know where you are. And from a strict standpoint of security, it's not more secure. Rather, it's concentrated vulnerability. And we have seen some attacks recently where somebody got in to their Google account and then had access to all of the places that they had logged in with Google apps.
Point.
So it explodes this problem. I mean, so again, there are trade-offs for all these things.
Yeah.
And so anyway, my hope is that a website that adopted Squirrel would see, wow, we're getting more submissions now because we've reduced the friction of turning people away from, because we no longer need for them to create an account from scratch. So, you know, there are benefits on the server side, not just the fact that there's no passwords that they have to protect any longer. Squirrel gives them no secrets to keep.
Right.
So there are multiple benefits.
I think, Steve, one thing is, if you really want to make sure that it takes off, make sure you get your own channel on the Stack Exchange and ensure that developers can share the code.
No.
It's not a bad idea.
No, we want that, for sure.
By the way, I do have one more question.
Good.
You invented your own crypto for this.
No, a 100% Lib Sodium. So it's all off-the-shelf standard crypto.
Okay, so you've got the papers that show that this is withheld. The big crippies are okay with what you've done.
Yes.
Okay, that's important.
Roll your own encryption is the end.
It's a death.
Yeah.
Rolling your own encryption with known pieces still leaves holes in it.
It's so easy to make a mistake.
It really is. And these guys, they come up with
crypt sign, sign encrypt.
All that stuff.
What do you do?
Okay.
Here's a good one. What biometric identification tool is nobody talking about but will happen in the next 10 years? We know face, we know iris. I was talking to somebody who said the best way is DNA.
It's hard to change your password.
That's the problem, right?
Generally,
if I give you my social security number,
can be
I'm
very
stuck.
Painful.
Is
that possible at all?
There are others. I'm on a couple of program committees, and I read papers that are coming out next year on stuff like this. There are people, of course, who use voice now.
Yeah, my broker says
your
voice.
Broker
and
now
I don't
listens.
Trust that. Is that
deepfake?
Okay?
It is a mild improvement, but it can be fooled.
Right.
On the
it
other
would
hand,
be a good additional factor.
That's exactly right. And that may also be true if you say, Alexa, buy half a ton of creamed corn.
so if you have a different phrase.
The point is that when you make these requests, there are people who are saying, we can do some voice identification with a voice. However, I've just finished reading a paper that showed that can really be fooled.
Yeah.
Don't none of this stuff is perfect. And there's Iris, I think.
Iris scan, yeah.
Iris scan works on Android, right? I mean, you got a camera in here. There's
it's kind
no
of
reason.
Unclear whether it's Iris scan or something a little less.
Yeah, and you know, you don't look for a perfect solution. If you have five different assurances, that's great. Here's one that a friend of mine came up with. When you get a phone call, that voice, that sound goes through different codecs on the way. It might come over voice over IP or through a phone system. He came up with a paper back in the mid 2005 or so that could tell which different codecs that sound came through.
Wow.
In order.
Wow.
Which means you have some idea of where the call came from and so on. And this would. I said this was a very cool paper, and I loved it, and he eventually got it published. And I asked him recently how it went, and he said, we now have a company with 300 people using this.
Wow.
Nice. Who's using this? When you call on those 800 numbers or what have you, they are giving information about how that call got to you.
It's a trace
route. Got to them.
It's a voice
it
trace route.
It isn't exactly trace route, but, you know, grandma using her wall phone is going to be different than some hacker in Latvia.
Right.
And that it's just another light on the screen.
Another indicator.
That says this is good or this is bad.
Well, it's like browser fingerprinting, which is surprisingly unique and accurate.
So these things all get bundled together. And once again, the MBAs or their spreadsheets figure out what matters the most. And of course, you do deep learning on this. This call seems to be coming from Latvia, and it has these things.
Yeah.
I recommend that there's an 89% chance this is bogus.
Well, and also, we're seeing the cost of biometrics falling constantly, right?
Oh, yeah.
So face recognition wasn't even feasible 10 years ago.
Right.
At this point, Apple discontinued fingerprint in lieu of face, but you could have both. I mean, I'm holding my phone,
right.
And so if you begin to compound these, then again, you raise the number of
bits.
It's a
lot harder.
16 bits for this, plus 20 bits for that.
Yeah.
Now you're at 36 bits.
Right.
And I think you have a couple of, I think it's going to be really interesting what kind of sensors we're going to be having down the road. So it's like we have sensors today that we can use, like this. But even the accelerometer in your phone, is like what kind of angle do you hold the phone typically when you type in or when you phone, that gives additional information that's fairly unique.
We saw the story where people could use lasers to identify you by your heart rate 1,000 meters away.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. My Clearly. Phone can do that from microns away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe more useful 1,000 meters.
Yes.
What behaviors, this might be for you, Gerald, what behaviors help our employees' security posture the most? That's always a problem in the enterprise.
So, and I think the most important answer to that is I got to plug Cybersecurity Awareness Month a little bit because that's where October, and it's like this is Cybersecurity Awareness Month. I think awareness and training is like the most important piece in order to help employees do the right things. There's not a single silver bullet. So obviously, it's like using a password manager to secure your password is a good idea. Making sure that you patch your own personal kind of things at home and as well as in the company, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it goes on and on, but I think the most critical piece in this kind of context overall is to make sure that people are aware of security issues, are actively engaged in this, and make security part of their work life and their personal life. Because without that, you really end up being in a situation where you can have as much technology as you want, as much gimmicks as you want. If people are able to bypass, then guess what? They will.
And I think that's a really good point too, because we assume that people understand this stuff. I mean, even though we know they don't, it's hard to understand how little they do.
Mm-hmm.
And so a little bit of education probably goes a long way.
Absolutely.
In terms of just changing their behavior enough to help them be more secure.
Yeah. I do want to push back against the education thing a little bit. Some of this is an engineering problem. Why is
it's our fault.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why should you?
That's right.
Have to
well, except this doesn't. This doesn't give an immediate answer. Why should there be anything you can click on in your email that's going to hurt your computer?
Yeah.
You know, this whole thing of, oh, don't click on it, or it's going to be, know where it comes from, right, and that sort of stuff.
Right.
This is just bad engineering.
Right.
Oh, totally agree. And it's like, I really want to make sure. It's like, it's not necessarily about education, about being able to triage and do your own kind of threat model as you get an email and make sure it's like, can I not? That's not the problem. But it's like making sure that that you have a general security awareness, not a necessarily deep knowledge. I don't want everyone to become like an entry-level kind of a security engineer.
It won't help.
And it wouldn't happen anyways.
Even if you knew what you're doing, and it's happened to me, you can still get fooled.
But making sure that you know that, yeah. And it's like in real life. It's like there are dark corners of the city or dark corners of the real world where you really don't want to go to. And this is kind of like a thing that's like developed this kind of awareness across the board, also in the quote-unquote cyber realm, that there are certain things you naturally don't want to do.
Well, and you can imagine after this whole spate of ransomware attacks this summer, there must be municipal employees who are just walking around like this, afraid to touch anything.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if they click the wrong button, they're going to get their whole county encrypted.
Absolutely.
Somebody asked if...
that's a good point.
Literally.
I'm surprised it hasn't happened yet, but it's going to.
Yeah.
This year. This is going to be the year the county gets encrypted. Maybe
Louisiana
state.
Had a cyber emergency.
Yeah. Cyber emergency. That's not a phrase you want to hear.
Nope.
Are you doing outreaches to schools? That kind of thing? Somebody wants to know if you've got school outreach.
Oh, yeah.
In Massachusetts.
So from a LogMeIn perspective, and obviously LastPass perspective, we have now STEM Week. Or the STEM week, so we're actively reaching out to K-12 kind of schools.
You don't do security education, though, in schools or anything like that?
We work closely. So, actually, my daughter is right now in AP Comp Sci, and they're going to have a field trip coming to LogMeIn visiting us. She's kind of embarrassed that I'm talking about this right now. I know that for a fact.
What's her name? Let's really
Melinda.
Embarrass her. Melinda.
Hi, Melinda.
Actually, Chez teaches rocket science to second graders. I don't know how well that's going.
Actually, it works out really well. My latest challenge is to teach exponential growth to fourth graders who are learning biology. They don't know what an exponent is, but we can do that anyway.
What a great thing to teach them with a hockey stick.
Grains of sand on chessboards and that sort of stuff.
Nice.
There's one suggestion I would have to people to think about. You know, Time Machine is easily the best backup system I've ever seen in my career.
Really?
Yes. It's just so easy. It just works.
It works.
Yep. It just works. But I keep a second Time Machine that I use once a year.
This is Apple's Mac OS backup solution.
Yes. I plug it in and then I take it offline. So that disk is sitting over in a corner someplace.
That's your ransomware.
So
solution.
If some ransomware comes in, good ransomware is going to reach out into your backup and do that
right.
too.
Steve and I talked about cold backup.
Oh, does it? I'm not surprised, but it was going to happen, you know.
And if only Steve had backed up his Bitcoin password.
That's not a bad idea.
Oh, I still don't know my password. I've got a lot of entropy on that password. I haven't figured that one out.
We can help you with remembering that in the future.
Well, see, that's why I thought it must be an easy password. I didn't put it in LastPass.
Yeah.
But now I...
This was before LastPass.
No.
Oh, no?
There's nothing before LastPass. Ah. I've been using LastPass since they started. It's been a decade, I think. When did LastPass start?
2009, yeah.
2009, yeah. It's been literally a decade, yeah.
Decade.
And then, Steve, I talked to you into talking to Joe and looking at it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So that was a little more recent, but not much. This is for everybody, but specifically for Steve. Now that we've achieved quantum supremacy, are you worried about your elliptic curve crypto?
That's a good question.
Good question. So the very first parameter in the communication between the client and server is the version number, which then determines the format of everything that follows. So
you could upgrade it.
So yes.
What's next? If I mean, we're not going to have quantum computers in my lifetime.
Oh, we will.
They're.
You think?
How are you feeling?
Well, that
today?
Depends how I feel.
IBM's up to 53 bits.
Yep. Are they really?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Stable.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's even online.
Yep.
Wow. All right.
Yeah. So the good news is
that's a problem because that this calculation of prime factoring. When you have a computer that's orders of magnitude faster.
The good news is the academics have needed to do something for the last 5 or 6 years. So they've been focused on post-quantum crypto.
Yes.
And they've already got that in place.
So there are ways
so
to do it.
So it is solved.
Is it still factored?
And in fact, there's some post-quantum in TLS 1.3
really?
Also. So we
yeah,
already
this,
have...
If you want to check it out, NIST actually has a fairly comprehensive kind of package online that talks about post-quantum crypto and their requirements for government crypto, et cetera, et cetera. You can assume that... I think they're projecting that it's like until 2025 or 2030, we will still be okay with, like from an RSA perspective with the 3072-bit, but it's like after that you want to upgrade. So I think there's like a thinking is like how there's fast crypto will
so after your Windows 7 machines finally die.
Yes, XP. XP.
Yeah, that's right. You know, Matt Blaze points out that cryptography is the one field we hope there won't be breakthroughs in.
Let's settle the debate. Tabs or spaces?
Tabs.
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 Absolutely. Tabs, no question.
I'm not going to weigh in on this
here
one.
Here you go. Now they're going to ask what editor we use.
Then went out. A lot of questions about quantum computing, which is interesting.
One of the quick answers on quantum computing is double your key length.
Yep.
You know, then because quantum halves the key, effective key size.
Yep. So if I have a 4,096-bit key, I should go to 8,192?
That would be the answer. If 4,000 was, 4,000 is a lot.
That's pretty big. That's what
it
I've
is.
Been using.
You know,
it's pretty big.
Leo, you already doubled it and got to 4,000.
I already doubled it.
Yes. You know,
I don't have to double it again?
No.
This is a supercomputer. This little thing has more power than the Cray computer we had at Bell Labs in 1990.
That's amazing.
It's got plenty of power
no
to
couch.
Do a little crypto. This is a 10.
It's
there's
amazing.
Plenty of power. You want 8? You want 8K bit? Go ahead. You might wait an extra 2 seconds on some transaction.
That's really true. That whole notion of, it's expensive to do this stuff is kind of
gone by the
wayside.
No, it's gone. Crypto's easy.
Yeah.
Well, it's doing face recognition. I mean, come on.
And it's doing it the hard way.
Yes, 3D with laser dots.
3D and doing machine learning and stuff.
Yeah. It's actually, there's some good questions about how you all keep your security. How do you authenticate? How do you personally authenticate your admin account on your computers in your house? Do you just use a password?
Yeah.
My root password is the letter X.
It's fast. It's easy.
It's easy to remember.
In your bathroom,
if
who
you
cares?
Ever get to where you can use it, I have already lost.
Good answer.
Yes.
Good answer.
That and Leo, remember I told you, I guess it was this morning, that I had removed the computers from my house while I'm traveling for exactly that reason.
We won't tell you where he put them. And I pointed out, that's pretty easy to get into. But he said, but nobody would expect them there.
Yeah.
So.
And we know that security by obscurity is not great, but it's better than nothing.
What's the sweet spot between convenient and creepy? Is it, for instance, easy to use is okay, but face recognition at the airport is creepy. So this is a question that really comes down to how you guys think differently than we do. Because you understand why face recognition at the airport is not the same as face recognition on an iPhone. How does a normal person
I think it's also cultural and maybe generational kind of thing, because what used to be creepy like way back when is no longer creepy at all. Sure everyone has seen the pancake thing, where it's like in the 60s we were really worried about the government wiretap in our house. In 2019 we say like, hey, wiretap, what's the good recipe for a pancake? Right? So I think it changes over time and it changes over cultures.
Do you have any voice assistants in your house?
I actually have one in my pocket.
Oh, yeah, we all do, don't we?
Exactly.
How about you, Chiz?
Hey, Siri, set timer for 20 minutes.
So you're not worried about... Steve, do you?
None.
No,
zero.
You don't like that.
No.
I've just set at least 2 devices to 20 minutes, probably dozens more.
Yeah. That's good, because at 20 minutes, we're done. So all of watches will go off in the place.
That's right.
Why don't you worry about that, Chiz?
I do. Actually, I have a she who must not be named, because we don't use the word Alexa in our house,
yes.
Except when we want to talk to her.
Right.
We use it all over the place. This is partly because I'm an early adopter, And I want to know how, I love living in the future, and I want to know how this stuff works.
And also, once again, if you're close enough to his Alexa in order to speak to her.
What about who's on the other end? You know, that's the issue.
Well,
right?
So there are a whole bunch of questions about it. Is the device hackable the way a lot of IoT devices are? And I've been reading a lot of papers where people have sort of looked at this, and it is tight enough that it's hard for a researcher to examine what's going on there, which is a good sign. And so I sometimes when you're doing security judgments, the question is, are the people who are designing this seem to have the right attitude? And if the answer is yes, that's the best you're going to get.
Yeah.
By the way, that's one of the reasons I like the Postfix mailer by Vitsa Venema. He is really very particular about this stuff. That's been out for like 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I want to find out what it's like to be able to talk, and I can turn on my fountains and do all sorts of stuff with my with the Alexa at home. I use Siri all the time. I have looked into it. I think it's pretty safe. I'm actually thinking of putting a second, I'm popping my peas here, putting a second network into my house called The Good Place, which will have no passwords, and it will have all the stuff I don't trust, like Samsung TVs and cameras.
Steve does this. It's basically a VLAN for untrusted VLAN.
And then I want to watch every piece of packet that goes in and out. Yep. Maybe even go out to eBay and buy all the crappiest, most dangerous stuff and put them on The Good Place. But I... this question, actually, it's a really good question about creepy and convenient. And it's something I've been thinking about because, you know, if you had a lot of money 250 years ago in your manor, you had a butler. And that butler knew everything about you, knew if you were stepping out on your wife, knew what your finances were, knew all this stuff.
And your socks were dirty.
They knew all of that stuff. And yet you trusted them. And what we have now is the digital equivalent, and I've actually gone back trying to find a manual for butlers from like 250 years ago to find out what the butler rules were that might be guidelines for people who are designing the stuff in here. Because I want this to know me as well as a butler, and in many ways it knows it better. I walk out of the building and it says, it's 41 minutes to your home and the traffic's light. You know, I wasn't even thinking I was going home yet.
Jeeves didn't even know that, yeah.
And I think that is really slicker than snot
That's
on
cool.
a doorknob.
Yeah.
But it could be creepy. And you have to figure out this balance between that. And it is one of the questions we have, and we'll see how the market...
And I do think we're talking about a generational shift.
Yes, that's part of it.
Between, you know, kids just don't... They think, hey, great. You know, there's like no downside in their minds, whereas we old farts here, it's like, ugh, how does it know that?
Right. My kids are pretty creeped out when I showed up on Facebook.
Well, I just want to thank you guys so much. I mean, this has been a really fun and interesting conversation. Don't you agree? I think that you guys are doing fascinating stuff at LastPass. We're really so pleased to be partnered with you, and we thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to come out and do this and to get Chez and get Steve and get this conversation going. So thank you very much, Jerry. I really appreciate it. Bill Cheswick, thank you for coming out and taking the train and spending some
My
time
pleasure.
With us.
My pleasure. What fun.
Thanks for the honey.
Yeah, there you go. I'll bring you more next time.
And Steve, we want to learn more about Squirrel, and I know we will. We're going to do a special on Squirrel.
Yep.
And, of course, every Tuesday you and I talk on Security Now. And if you're interested in this kind of thing, I think that's a great way to kind of keep up on what's going on the... Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We're going to stick around. I know you all want to get selfies with Steve, so we're going to stick around. The selfie line will begin down here, and we can continue the conversation. And I didn't get to half the questions. Thank you. Great questions, all of them.
You also going to be the selfie. I've already got the Steve selfie.
I'll do a selfie. You got the Steve. I'll do a selfie, too. Absolutely. I'm sure Jerry and Chez will, too. So thank you all for being here. We really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks.
Thank you.
I could go for another hour. Look at the block and say, oh, that was really fun.